Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Staying Aligned podcast brought to you by Steele and Eisner. I am your host today, Alexander Eisner. I am not going to be joined by Mr. Sean Steele. He is at a convention, an unnamed convention, somewhere in the contiguous United States. But I am, however, joined by an incredibly special guest. He is a world-class medical malpractice plaintiff's attorney. He practices with his father and his brother. It's a family practice. He is a trial attorney. He has an incredible wealth of information on the subject, but more than all of those things, he is my best friend, was in my wedding, known for a long, long time. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Brad Walken.
Thank you so much for having me. I reciprocate all those feelings, but maybe even more than you feel them. I feel them. That's what I want you to know.
It's not possible. It's not possible at all. So we've talked about this. This is a 30-minute session. We go right to the point and try to jump straight in. So the audience, of course, being mostly chiropractic. And so you as a medical malpractice attorney, there's a ton of misinformation in my sort of opinion around med mal from just what I hear from non-attorneys. A lot of people think they have a case anytime there's like a bad outcome at a doctor's office. Can you explain sort of in basic terms first, just what is a medical malpractice case? What does that mean? What are the requirements? What is med mal?
Sure. I think to say that there's a lot of misinformation is super accurate. The phone rings nearly constantly every single day, inclusive of weekends. With people who just, they know they have a case and it's just a question of, you know, how much money and when, and usually the how much is, you know, tons and significantly more than the law would allow for. But a medical malpractice case is really just three things. Four, if you want to be highly technical, but it boils down to three. We have to prove that there was a mistake, that the mistake caused harm, mistake causing harm. If we can establish that there was a breach in the standard of care, that it was a substantial factor in causing some injury. And then we have to lay out what that injury is. If we can do those things, we have a medical malpractice case. If we can do one or two of those things, but not all three of those things, we do not have a case. So when the person calls and they say, I've been hurt, when do I get my money? I can understand where they're coming from and I can empathize, but we have to start at first principles. What is the alleged mistake? And we kind of get into that. What impact did it have, if any, on the damages that you have sustained? And it's the evaluation of those three elements, those three legs of the stool, so to speak, that would make up a medical malpractice case.
Okay. Very succinct. Great definition. And you're looking sharp today, by the way. I didn't say that to you earlier. Your hair, especially, real, really on point.
I can be so sharp. There's a lot of dullness, and then I put it together.
What is MICRA? What is MICRA? How does it affect doctors? Does it help them or hurt them? How does it inform medical settlements, med mal settlements? Talk us through MICRA in a nutshell.
Yeah, so MICRA is the term that we use to describe broadly a set of laws that govern medical malpractice cases. And it sets med mal cases in really to their own universe. So a medical malpractice case is not like the world that you occupy, the personal injury world. It's not like really anything else. It's its own thing. MICRA, this set of laws, was put in place initially. I don't want to offend anybody. I don't know how old the audience may be, but let's say a little while back in 1975, it's been recently amended in some key ways in the last really 2 years, 1 year. But basically, it's the rules of the road for medical malpractice cases. It sets up what needs to be proven. It puts certain limits on the recovery. The potential recovery in the case, there are caps, ceilings that apply to damages and how much money, even assuming a meritorious case, how much money somebody can be awarded. Overall, I think it is very, very helpful for the defense, meaning the people that we are litigating against. Our office exclusively attempts to help people who have been hurt. And while I don't have any truly fundamental disagreements with the nature of what must be proven to have a case, I have some thoughts about whether any type of damages cap is really reasonable, and that's definitely part of MICRA. But in terms of impact to a practitioner who's Perhaps on the other side, if we assume that there's a meritorious case and it's been properly vetted, MICRA is going to be very helpful because it establishes a framework within which every single medical malpractice case must be analyzed. And like I was talking about with these ceilings, it puts borders around case value. And case value borders allow for predictability of outcome. So it allows an insurance company to evaluate the case. It allows a defendant to evaluate what their exposure may be. And within reason, it can kind of let everybody know these are the broad parameters within which the case gets analyzed. That type of predictability, I think, is very helpful to know as someone who is being sued. And so I think it does help everybody know what to expect and to plan for.
Okay. And so you talked about a cap. There's a cap on pain and suffering damages. That requirement that an expert provide testimony in order to support a medical malpractice case. I imagine that has a pretty big impact on whether or not a case is viable from a liability standpoint, meaning you can't just say, well, that seems wrong, and I think I could convince a jury that that seems wrong, so we're going to bring this case. That's not enough in medical malpractice, right? Where it might be in PI, and I can just stand up and make an argument that that driver messed up and, you know, try to get a jury to agree with me that that driver messed up. You have to have, by law, you have to have an expert in that same field that agrees with you that doctor's conduct fell below a standard of care. That's right?
That's right. That's right. Dr. Google, although it can be helpful to me as I'm trying to get a sense as to whether to take a next step and actually investigate the merits of a potential case, not enough. My own personal feelings, which are completely irrelevant as I'm not a healthcare provider, but my own personal feelings certainly aren't enough. The framework of every case, the base analysis is we get a call in, Joe Blow off the street, and they have in their minds or their loved one has sustained an injury. I try my best. I listen to what the potential medical malpractice issue is. What is it that may have gone wrong? I try to get a sense for damages because there are cases where the damages may not be large enough to justify all that a medical malpractice case entails. If after that, it's something that I want to further explore and see if we can help, that's not the end of the analysis. That's the very, very beginning. I would typically say, all right, I'm going to need a complete copy of the medical records from the various healthcare providers that have seen you or your loved one. Please send them in. Then I look at them and we can talk about what it is that I'm looking for as a layperson who's also a medical malpractice attorney as to how do I take the next step. But after I've reviewed it, if it still seems like a case that it could be meritorious, that's when we go about making sure before we file a lawsuit, before we do anything else, is it a case? That's when the medical experts get involved. And so we'd reach out to whoever's appropriate. It's very simple on my end because I match apples to apples. If we're critical of a cardiologist, then only a cardiologist is going to know whether the standard of care was met or whether it was breached. And so we would send the key records over to a cardiology expert. And if they give us the feedback, if they give us the thumbs up, yes, this was a breach in the standard of care. Okay, fine. We take the next step in the analysis. And certainly if they give us feedback that this was not a breach in the standard of care, it's done. Nothing else happens. I certainly would not take the case. I would advise the client, I'm so sorry, this one didn't come together in the way that we would need. And that's the end of it. It's the end of the analysis.
So you talked about damages there for a second. And I want to ask you, and you sort of were talking about the legs of the stool. And so I'm sort of going to play a scenario out where one of the legs gets kicked out and see how that affects everything. So, you know, let's say you've got a situation where a doctor very clearly messed up, right? Very, very obvious liability case, right? Where, you know, we're talking the doctor left the scissors in the abdomen or, you know, something where it's just very clear that there's no way they're going to be able to say that the doctor didn't mess up. But there's no damages. There's no damages at all, right? You got a client that calls you that says, they left scissors in my stomach. And then you go, well, what happened as a result? And then they say, well, they caught it before the surgery ended. They took them out and everything was fine afterwards, or I don't know, something like that. And then there's no damages at all. Is there any compensation for those people? Is there any compensation for people who had legitimate things happen to them, right? A doctor actually messed up and it's clear as day, but nothing bad really happened to the person other than that they had to sort of endure the knowledge and psychological trauma of knowing that a doctor messed up something?
Well, I can speak for me, and I can speak for my family and how we as a firm analyze cases. In the situation that you described, there is no compensation for them through us. It would not be a case that I would recommend pursuing, even though as I'm talking to that person on the phone and I share with them, after understanding that there's really no damage, I share with them, this isn't a case we can take on. They will, if they're normal, start calling me all the regular names, all the names that are found in the book, which I can understand as a human being, but legally it's just not a case. We must have all three legs. In the same way that you could imagine a case in which the damages that were sustained are catastrophic, life-altering, whether it's someone's passing, whether it's a stroke that's left them absolutely debilitated, where they're not able to do anything for themselves and they require 24/7 care, their loved one has to be changing their diapers and doing all these things that are obviously, you know, horrible, tragic things. Although those major, major damages could be in play, and although the case value in a stroke case or in a wrongful death case might be very, very large, if there was not a breach in the standard of care, it is not a case. Right. Even if there was a breach in the standard of care, if the bad outcome was likely to have happened anyways, if it probably would have occurred, even if there was no alleged mistake, then even a mistake, but with no causation and huge damages, literally not a case. And right. It's a difficult thing to explain to people, but that's the law. And it should be, by the way, if there weren't all three legs, not a lawsuit. No one should have to pay. There should be no compensation. I think it's right. A simple thing.
And I end up with it similarly on my end when we're dealing with cases with damages, but, you know, admitted liability. Sometimes people will try to create a situation where the egregiousness of the conduct leads directly to the compensation as opposed to the damages driving the compensation. And I hear that all the time. Well, he was driving drunk and he was texting while driving and he fled the scene after the accident. The cops had to track him down. You know, shouldn't that be worth something? It's like, yes, it's worth exactly whatever your damages are, which in this case are very little. So like, yes, that piece of the puzzle has to be there to create a lawsuit, but it's not in and of itself. It doesn't in and of itself create damages. The damages have to be its own piece of the puzzle.
Right. So that's true. And damages can be physical in the sense that, for example, my dominant arm no longer functions the way that it should. Damages can be purely emotional. That counts. That's totally fine. In the scissors situation, knowing that a bad thing happened in and of itself, assuming he didn't have to, for example, have a second surgery, they didn't have to elongate right. The scar. He's not going to have damages beyond knowing that this horrible thing happened. There's nothing there. And it brings to mind a case where, kind of egregiously, a patient was in a convalescent home and was ultimately found to have worms, weevils growing out of their nose. They were completely unconscious, convalescing, but their loved ones would come by and they would see that there are live worms inside their loved one's nose that are coming out. It was, and you know, photos, there are videos. It's a thing that happened, but there is no compensation for that person because that person was comatose. They ended up not being able to make it out of their state and they passed away. That person never was able to appreciate that any of this was going on. They just weren't. And although you could imagine that from a liability perspective, allowing worms to grow in someone's body does not pass the sniff test. Let's just say there was no compensation. We weren't able to take the case because there was no appreciation of harm. There were no damages.
There were no damages, right? That condition in and of itself didn't make them any worse and they didn't suffer any pain. And yeah, I mean, that's a great example, although a kind of a messed up example, but a great example of exactly what we're talking about, which is a situation where the conduct is egregious. It's very obvious that there's liability, but there's just no damages. And so there's no way to compensate that person for that injury, which is difficult for a lot of people to wrap their minds around. I want to transition to chiropractic because that's the audience we're talking to and we don't have a ton of time. And I want to talk about so you've got somebody who comes in with suspected med mal from a chiropractor, right? And let's say I'm going to create a hypothetical situation where they come in with back pain at a 2 out of 10 and the chiropractor does an adjustment, and now they're claiming their back pain is an 8 out of 10, right? So they're claiming that the chiropractor made them worse. And I imagine that this is part of sort of the most common of the chiropractic claims of malpractice that exist, these sort of vague and unsubstantiated subjective claims that before was better than after is worse. What kinds of questions are you asking? How does that conversation go with this client? And then walk me through the process of determining whether or not you've got a case.
Yeah, it is a very, very common call that we get. Not unique to alleged chiropractic malpractice, but anything, even if it's a surgery gone wrong. But in the chiropractic setting, a claim of exacerbation of a pre-existing injury by a chiropractor is something that people subjectively feel. And it may even be true, but the analysis of whether it's a case is the same that we've kind of been talking about. It's a very, what I'd like to think is methodical step-by-step approach. So someone calls, they feel that they've been made worse by an adjustment or adjustments. The first thing that I want to understand is, what were you like before? Had you ever seen a chiropractor before? What was your relationship with chiropractic medicine or just overall medical history? Certainly if there were ever any visits with an orthopedist or with a spine specialist, we have to understand what is the baseline. And then I'd like to try to understand what is it specifically that you feel was done that was wrong? Aside from, and then they'll repeat, well, my back hurts worse, but I have to help them understand that. No, what I mean is we're going to sue this person, hypothetically, potentially. What are we going to specifically criticize this person for doing as they were attempting to help you? And so give me your sense. And what it typically boils down to is they'll say they were too hard. They were too aggressive. I told them X, Y, Z, and they cranked on my back or whatever, because these are lay people, obviously. And they don't have the vocabulary to describe in more detail than that. I mean, frankly, I don't think that anything like what you and I are talking about in this hypothetical would make for a good case. I can't imagine a world in which I would be interested to investigate that case. But if we imagine that this patient goes from a 2 to an 8 on the pain scale, and they perhaps don't see the potential defendant chiropractor again, they establish care with a new provider, that new provider makes a comment that, you know, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way, or I wouldn't have done that. That starts to very, very, very narrowly open the door. It doesn't throw the door wide open and, oh, now there's a case because that one person says, without having reviewed the medical records, that they may have approached it differently. But what we're looking for, or what I'm looking for in any case, is what is the angle? What is the thing that separates this potential case from those people who unfortunately may have a bad reaction to surgery, to an adjustment, to anything? How is it that we're going to be able to establish that there was a breach in the standard of care? Unless there, in this context, with the 2 to an 8, unless there was a really specific angle, nothing, in my opinion, would come from it. If there was, and if we imagine perhaps the damages are more significant than a subjective change of 6 points on the scale, then we would consider getting a chiropractic expert review.
And that brings up a question that somebody just asked in the Q&A, which is, So within chiropractic, there's a lot of different schools of thought and different types of care and practice within that. And the question asks essentially, how does that standard of care work as it relates to different types of chiropractic care and different practices?
Yeah.
You go ahead. I mean, how does that work in terms of hiring an expert to opine on the standard of care?
It's a great question. And it all comes down to apples, matching up experts. So I, as a layperson, I couldn't tell you the different practices and the different approaches that are taken, but I don't need to. My task is slightly different. If we're going to have a case reviewed, the standard of care is what a quote unquote reasonable insert type, a reasonable chiropractor, a reasonable cardiologist, a reasonable podiatrist would have done under the same or similar circumstances. And it is not a hard and fast, there is no bright line where that is, that isn't. Whether there's a breach in the standard of care comes down to the opinion of properly qualified practicing medical experts. And so if I was to have a case reviewed by an expert who is a chiropractor, I would hope that that person would be sensitive to that exact question. I mean, they should be. And if the potential defendant comes from a different school or comes at it from a different approach, I would expect that they'd be aware of it. So I have to rely upon our experts. If I can properly vet the expert, I have to rely upon them to sensitize me to these things. And if they review the case, and typically what they'll say is, because I've had this happen, that's not really my approach. But my approach isn't the standard of care. I'm familiar with that approach, and now I can offer an opinion as to whether within that approach specific to it, that was or was not below the standard of care. So it all gets baked in, it all counts. And I think there's an acknowledgement, and there should be, that there's not just one way of doing things. And so it all comes down to the expert educating me and pointing us in the right direction. The best thing that an expert can do is just to tell me what they honestly think. If it's a case, that's great. If it's not a case, that sometimes is better, because I do not want to be suing somebody, anybody who does not deserve it. And if it's not likely to result in a good outcome for the client who's been hurt, but it comes down to an expert. They tell us.
Well, and I think that that's an incredibly important point to make, especially to doctors who, you know, doctors sort of practice in a little bit of fear of medical malpractice. And there's so much misinformation. There's so much concern about getting sued that I think they would be surprised, and I could be wrong about this, but I think they would be surprised to hear you say what you just said, which is, look, I want to be the first one to know if I don't have a case. I'm not shoehorning maybe cases into cases by hiring, you know, less than scrupulous experts to tell me what I want to hear, which is, I think, what the preconceived notion might be of medical malpractice attorneys. I know it's the preconceived notion of PI attorneys is that, oh, well, they'll take anybody who says my back hurts and try to make that into some giant case by getting any doctor with an MD after their name to agree that, you know, that's a case. But that's not the case, and not the case for me, and it's not the case for you. I want to be the first one to know if I don't have it, and I'm not interested in the least in trying to make a play for a case that I'm going to get beat on experts all day long. They're going to hire a legitimate expert who's going to legitimately say they don't have it, and a jury is going to see through that. And then I will have wasted a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of money to potentially lose a case, which nobody wants to do, least of all my client. And I'm sure that's the same thing with you.
It is. I mean, I empathize with doctors. I empathize with hospitals. I certainly empathize with healthcare providers, nurses, and all these secondary providers. I can imagine as a human what it's like to get the piece of paper from me or from my firm that says there's a lawsuit now, and now this is something that you have to grapple with, think about. It implicates your core essence as a person who's, I mean, everybody is trying to help. I can imagine. And I don't think of myself this way explicitly, but I am sort of a bulwark against frivolous claims. I won't make them. If I have a case that I think is legitimate and I learn perhaps it's not, I will drop that case immediately. And the number of times that we get cases reviewed purely as to the merits, this is before anything else has been done, and it's a thumbs down, it's not a case, far, far exceeds the number of times that it is a legitimate case. But the other point I would make is, let's imagine that we get the case reviewed and we go to somebody that we know and that we trust, preferably somebody that the other side, that our colleagues on the defense know and trust, because those are the most effective experts that are fairly balanced. And I try to get experts to work with us who lean toward the defense side. I think it lends a lot more weight to their opinions, but let's imagine that I get the case reviewed and it is a thumbs up and we are going to take the next step. That doesn't mean that we win the case, because there is no bright line. It means that we have the ammunition to get into the arena and to fight. It means that we can pursue the case, but the immediate thing that our colleagues do on the defense, they'll get the case, it plops down on their desk, they'll try to figure out what it's about, they match apples to apples, they go get their expert reviews, and they'll go to somebody and they'll say, completely cold, take a look, please let me know what you think, which is the same thing that we do. If their expert happens to agree with ours, not in a cynical way, because everybody is entitled to it, but I imagine they'll say, thank you, doctor, very much, here's your check, and they'll go to somebody else and they'll get a second opinion as perhaps makes sense. But they get their expert reviews sorted out. And let's imagine that on the first review, so that we're not speculating about what happens after review number one, let's imagine that they get the case reviewed by someone they know and trust and who's testified, you know, for them before. And that person says, oh no, I don't think this is a case at all. I do not believe that the chiropractor breached the standard of care, or I don't believe there's causation or whatever. Then they should, and they do, defend the case vigorously every time. There is no such thing as a slam dunk medical malpractice case
Right.
Maybe excluding the scissors situation, but in general, there really isn't. And there's room for differences of opinion. That's what makes these cases, it's one of the things that makes these cases very challenging. They're often referred to as the battle of the experts, where you will have two well-intentioned, very qualified human beings, plus a third who's the defendant, you know, themselves, who just disagree medically. And it's the practice of law for you and me in the same way that it's the practice of medicine. And yep. there's not always a complete answer. And so our process when we're determining, you know, do we, don't we move forward once we have expert support, it extends a bit beyond just expert support, but it's still happening on the other side.
So I gotta push us. We got like 4 minutes left here, and I want to get this question out as maybe our last question, which is, we got a lot of conscientious chiropractors listening. And these are people who are attending live right now, who are spending part of their lunch day wanting to hear from you and want to know what they're, but people who are going to tune into this after the fact are people who are trying to do it right, right? The person who would listen to this is the person who really doesn't want to find themselves on your desk. Give them some tips. What could a chiropractor do who is conscientiously attempting to avoid medical malpractice? What can they do to limit the number of patients who seek guidance from a med mal attorney? And what can they do to limit the number of those cases that do find their way onto a medical malpractice attorney's desk that they say yes to?
That's a very good question. I can speak to it from the perspective of the types of things that, as I'm vetting a case, make me think this is probably not a case. And this might sound super, super obvious, but the better the charting, the more exhaustive the chart, the more descriptive the medical chart, typically the harder it is to find that angle that we talked about, to find that liability issue, and to really sink your teeth into it. If there's a very thorough or reasonably thorough examination, it's documented. If the prior medical history is well documented, if the basic normal things that I'm sure everybody, every chiropractor is doing their due diligence on their patient prior to the adjustments or their treatment plan being formed. But the better documented it is, I think it really tends to insulate the doctor, because at the very least, it will explain, here's my thought process, here are my objective findings, here are the subjective complaints, medical history, here's the plan. And whether that plan works wonderfully, which I'm sure in the vast majority of cases it does, or if it's one of those situations that happen from time to time where, despite a reasonable treatment plan, there is a negative change in the patient's condition. If the thought process is well documented, medicine doesn't require perfection. The law does not require perfection. There is room for a bad outcome to happen, but it not be the result of negligence. And documenting very well how it is that we arrived at the point where the alleged mistake was made, what the thought process was, how the patient was doing, how the patient responded to treatment. I think that the better the documentation is, the better it is on the defense side. It's when there's big gaps, and now we're getting into some he said, she said situation where the patient is reporting, they cranked on me at the level of whatever, and it's not necessarily charted quite what was done, it invites controversy in a way that could probably easily be avoided.
That is incredibly good advice. I mean, I end up having similar conversations for a different reason, but with chiropractors all the time, when we're talking about chiropractic ethics, we're talking about reasonable necessity of treatment and what is excessive treatment, and documenting the necessity of testing and those sorts of things. The way I tell chiropractors to limit their exposure as it relates to the chiropractic board is through charting, just making sure that you're covering your behind in terms of documenting pre-existing conditions that you find, documenting what you discussed with the patient, documenting your treatment plan, and then documenting your execution of that plan. Because, like, you're right, the law does not require medical perfection. You don't, just because you set out to make the patient feel better does not require that you actually make them feel better. Obviously, that's your goal, but there's such a thing as a known complication. There's such a thing as a treatment not going the way that you wanted it to go. And that's not medical malpractice. That's just what happens sometimes. I mean, we're not perfect. It's the practice of medicine, right? Like you were saying. So I think that documentation of stuff is just so vital for so many different things. And I see issues with it that rear their ugly heads in litigation. If, you've got copy paste errors that look sloppy, or things not well documented, you end up with problems both on the PI side, from the chiropractic board side, and now we're hearing from a potential medical malpractice side. So That's great advice. Well, look, we are at the end of our half hour. I have a hunch that people are going to have questions for me as it relates to you. And if you do, Alexander Eisner at steeleisner.com, you can reach out to me and I will make sure to get those questions answered. From Brad, he is a wealth of information on this topic. And I find myself calling him all the time, asking questions tangential to his practice, not infrequently. Brad, thank you so much for doing this. I know that this is sort of outside of your normal wheelhouse, but I know that the chiropractors would join me in thanking you for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. All right, we'll talk to you guys soon.